Random House Audio presents No Less Than Victory, a novel of World War II by Jeff Shara. Read for you by Paul Michael. To the reader. This is the third volume of a trilogy that tells the story of the Second World War in Europe through the eyes of a select few of the key participants. As in every story I've written, I feel I should mention that this is not a comprehensive historical account of the entire war. There are lengthy shelves in every library and every bookstore packed with volumes that have tackled the subject in far more detail. My primary goal is to take you back to this time, allowing these characters to tell their story as they lived it. There is no history in hindsight. In World War II, the men and women who took part were facing the greatest crisis of their lives. A crisis that shaped the future of mankind. Though the historian may analyze that crisis, examine it with the comfortable knowledge of what followed, to the men who fought this war and those who made the great command decisions, there was very little comfort at all. Every day brought new challenges and new decisions for the commanders, or a new urgency for the men who carried the rifle. The story here is true, the history accurate, and every event is real. My research focuses solely on the accounts of the participants, their voices, memoirs and collections of letters, diaries and photographs, and, in wonderfully poignant instances, interviews with living veterans. This book has to be described as a novel because there is dialogue, the everyday conversations that are not always recorded for posterity. And much of the story is told from the points of view of these characters themselves, taking you into their thoughts. Even the veterans aren't able to fill in all the blanks. I understand the risks of telling this kind of story. Many people have their own definite images of these iconic figures. Some of those images have been shaped by Hollywood, which is usually unfortunate. To a great many Americans, the name George Patton conjures up the face of George C. Scott. In the past, I have had people confront me with a certain level of outrage. One man specifically saying to me, "How dare you put words in the mouth of Robert E. Lee?" Fair enough. I accept the challenge. If I dare to put words into the mouths of any of the historical figures in my books, I had better feel comfortable that those words, and thoughts and emotions, are authentic. Otherwise, the characters will be counterfeit, and you, the reader, will know that immediately. Before I write a word, I dig as deeply as I can to find those voices, and the most gratifying success for me is when the writing begins and the story flows freely. It is a wonderful feeling to become that cliché, the fly on the wall, feeling as though I'm just the conduit, telling you what I'm seeing and hearing and feeling. You may certainly disagree with my portrayal of some of these men, and most assuredly, I cannot include every detail of every character's life. But by the end of this book, I hope you have a sense of who these people are, what they accomplished, and why we must not forget or dismiss their accomplishments. And I hope you find this to be a good story. That is, after all, the point. There is one aspect of this book that is different from the first two volumes of the trilogy. Though I have included German voices before, most notably Erwin Rommel, by the end of the war in Europe, many of the German hierarchy are dealing with a significant crisis that goes beyond what the war has done to their country. The reality of Hitler's reign can no longer be denied, and each man must confront his own conscience about what Hitler's Germany has become. To portray the Germans as one-dimensional goose-stepping cartoons would do a disservice not only to them, but to you. It is easy to cast judgment on these men today, as, at the Nuremberg trials, it was fairly easy then. But they are important to this story, and I feel that portraying them simply as the bad guys, while politically correct, would not be authentic. In a strange twist of coincidence, as I am writing this, I just returned from a brief trip to Washington, D.C., where I happened to be when the shooting incident occurred at the Holocaust Museum. That horrifying act was committed by an 88-year-old Holocaust denier. Toward the war's end, American GIs, and then the generals, discovered the worst of the Nazi concentration camps. Literally thousands of American and British soldiers witnessed firsthand the grotesque aftermath of the atrocities committed by the Germans. I am appalled by those who deny that the Holocaust took place. The accounts of the Allied soldiers and reporters who were there at the liberations of these camps, the sheer volume of evidence is so completely overwhelming that to deny it took place is both comically and tragically absurd. My fear is that the deniers have an agenda, political or social, and that by denying or even excusing what was done to those millions of human beings, their purpose could be to justify it happening again. If this book is emotional for you, or if, after reading it, you feel you understand a bit more about the war itself, or know a little more about those men who were so responsible for the history of this extraordinary event, then you and I share something. It has been my privilege to tell this story. Jeff Shara, June 2009. Introduction. With the success of the Normandy campaign, which concludes in August 1944, the Allied armies embrace their success with a euphoric confidence that Germany is on its last legs. The English, Canadian, and American armies that have punched their way across France have every right to feel that the victory they have gained is monumental. But that victory does not come without mistakes. The most critical error is the failure to close what is now known as the Argentan Falaise Gap, an 18-mile opening in a tightening ring that allows tens of thousands of German troops to escape toward their own borders. Blame for not closing the gap falls primarily on British Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery, but the British reciprocate by tossing responsibility toward the Allied Supreme Commander, Dwight Eisenhower. It is a controversy with no simple answer, but the results of the failure are soon made clear. Those German troops will fight again. As autumn comes to Europe, the Allies rely as much on arrogance as they do on wise tactics. To reward the accomplishments and placate the egos of his generals, Eisenhower pushes through changes in the command of his army. Montgomery, who had commanded the combined Allied ground forces at Normandy, is now limited to command of an army group that consists of his own British troops as well as the Canadian First Army. American General Omar Bradley is elevated to equal status with Montgomery and now commands all those American forces that have driven inland from Normandy, whose numbers continue to increase. To soothe Montgomery for the perceived slight to his authority and to blunt the howls of outrage in the British newspapers, he is promoted to the rank of Field Marshal. The Americans recognize the gesture for what it is, yet Montgomery continues to press Eisenhower with his own specific agenda for winning the war. To the dismay of the Americans under his command, Eisenhower accepts Montgomery's plan for a massive parachute drop along the northern flanks of the Allied front, an attempt to sweep around the strongest German defensive positions, opening a clear pathway toward Berlin. The attack will punch through the waterways and swampy plains that spread out along the boundaries separating Belgium, Holland, and northern Germany. Critical to the success of this operation is the capture of bridges across five separate rivers, including the bridge at Arnhem, which crosses the Rhine. With the bridges in Allied hands, British infantry and armor will then drive through the doorway held open by the paratroopers. Montgomery is confident that this assault not only will surprise the German defenders, but could also bring a rapid end to the war. On September 17th, 1944, Operation Market Garden begins. Three divisions of paratroopers, two American and one British, descend from the skies in broad daylight in the largest airdrop in history. For reasons Montgomery does not explain, the drop zone for the British 1st Airborne Division is 40 miles from their intended target of Arnhem. The delays and difficulties the British paratroopers encounter in reaching the bridge allow German defenses to respond, defenses that are far stronger than Montgomery has anticipated. Worse for the Allies, Montgomery's entire operational plans for the battle fall into German hands when an American officer who carries them in his pocket is captured.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?